buddy," she whispered. "Such delicate features. You will be a beauty yet." Molly opened her eyes. Her expression was unmoved. Two long fingers under her chin, tilting her face upward. "And what is it your Mr. Fool wants with Jonathan Cooper, child?"
Fool held his breath. He had been staring at Molly, at something in her face which she could not strangle. "Cooper," he said now, turning the name over in his mouth. "Jonathan Cooper."
"What have you told him, birdie, that Cooper had no face? Might your Mr. Fool want him for his particular talents, or has he offended in some fashion?" "Ah, yes, there it is. He has offended you."
Her nostrils flared as she took a long, slow, deep breath, and then her creeping hands fell still.
"It is true what you have heard, birdie," she continued. "We had some sight yet when he used to come here. We remember him. We could see his teeth through a hole in his cheek, grinning as if there were some joke in it all. But his eyes were awful, black all through, always weeping. Oh, it was not tears. He was as big as a horse, but his back was twisted so that he could not stand straight. He came for Anne in the small hours of the night. He used to run a finger over her ear and whisper to her in his rough Italian."
"Italian?" said Fool. Mrs. Sharper ignored him. "He never conducted any violence, sister," the thinner one called across. "Not on yourself, and not on any of our girls. But the two of them would quarrel, so.
Such a fierce creature, Anne was. So jealous."
"A jealous whore, sister." Fool rubbed a damp palm on his trouser leg. His tongue felt thick. The bad air of the parlour oozed around him, made his thoughts sluggish. "The stories they told you," he interrupted, speaking to Molly, "about the grindbones, what he would do to the littlest ones, what they protected you from. Ask them."
"Ask us what?"
Fool cleared his throat.
"He doubts the truth of them, sister."
"Their truth?" Mrs. Sharper waved her ravaged hand at the darkness.
"The truth that is found in a story is a different kind of truth, but it is not less real for being so. We had always known the truth of Mr. Cooper's nature."
"Oh, we knew what he was, sister."
"As did Anne."
"As did Anne.
That is why she left us, sister."
"She never left you," Molly said. She was staring at the old woman with a fascination Fool did not like the look of.
"She never left. You sent her away." "We caught her stealing from us, birdie. We had no choice but to ask her to leave. We could not keep a thief."
Fool cut his tongue along his teeth as if to sharpen it. He withdrew 2 5-pound notes from his pocket and stepped forward and set them down in front of Mrs. Sharper on the card table. "I should like very much to find French Anne," he said coldly. "I should like to speak with her." The banknotes disappeared into Mrs. Sharper's right fist, and she clutched them to her chest and started to trace her thumb around their edges. There came a rustling as the banknotes vanished into her blouse. The thinner sucked sharply at her teeth.
"Is it, sister?"
"It is."
"Very well. You wish to find French Anne, Mr. Fool? Look for her under the lime."
"The lime pits," he said.
"Is she dead, then?"
Mrs. Sharper glared a slow, smouldering glare.
"French Anne is dead, yes," she said. "But the woman who used to be her is not. She lives yet."
He stared at the old woman's clouded pupils, and then she turned her face towards him, and he felt the hairs prickle along his neck. She was looking at him. It was not possible, and yet it was so.
"She works the sewer mouth south of Blackfriars," Mrs. Sharper hissed. "Lives as a mudlark in the cubbies. They call her Muck Annie now. She never comes up from the tunnels. Or so we are told." "The berserkers, sister?"
Mrs. Sharper grunted and shifted her bulk. Fool could hear the click of her wooden fingers on the armrest.
"The tunnels are punishing, Mr. Fool," she murmured. "No one survives them for long. They are the haunts of the berserkers now. Even the police fear to go below. The berserkers will tear a man to pieces and leave him as feed for the rats, merely for the pleasure of it."
Fool steadied the slender walking stick in his grip. "How will I know her?" he asked.
"The scars."
"Yes." Mrs. Sharper waved her ruined hand in the darkness before her face.
"Here and here," she said.
She drew her thumb in a long crescent from each corner of her mouth, up her cheeks to her ears. "And the man, Cooper, is he with her?" Now the thinner shrugged slyly.
"It has been 15 years, Mr. Fool.
Our grand bones was useful in frightening the little ones, nothing more." She turned her baleful face from side to side.
"In this life, the lost stay lost," she said. "And Mr. Cooper was always among the lost."
"The dead do not come back, sister."
"Is that not so, child?"
Both lifting their faces as one, and searching with their milky eyes in the gloom.
"Child, Birdie, is it not so?"
Into the afternoon of the next day he slept. He dreamed an eyelash of light hovered beside his daybed, and then it turned and lengthened and grew, and when it bent over him, he saw that it was a child. It bore wings of a burning light, but its face was shadowed, and he feared to look into it.
"What is it?"
he asked, but the child only lifted one hand and pointed at his heart. He awoke with his heart hammering. His shirt was damp on his chest, and his left arm numb where he had rolled onto it, and he got up still shaken. He splashed his face with cold water at the basin, and dried himself, and studied his eyes in the pier glass. He did not know them. Then he changed his collar and fetched his frock coat, and went down the stairs to the emporium. He found Flood bowed over the roll-top desk beside the window, working at some correspondence, and he had the man go out into the weather and hail a hansom. He leaned into the fog as he descended the front steps to the street, and as he stepped up into the cab, it shuddered under his weight, and he reached around and banged on the roof, and called out his destination. They rode smoothly through the fog, and it seemed to Fool as they went that the fog had no end. At the door of the mortuary, an assistant with a stutter met him and led him inside. His pinched mouth, black gums, the dirt in the wrinkles around his red eyes. They passed down a narrow corridor and through a heavy door into the underground itself, without speaking, and when the man leaned in close to hold the door open, Fool could smell the gin in his apron. The assistant handed him a bull's-eye lantern with the shutter half-closed, and gestured him deeper. Then the man vanished back the way they had come. There were bodies laid out on metal tables along either wall, and Fool went past them without a glance. Shapes rose up and disappeared in the shadows. He went quietly. It was not his first time among the dead. At the far end, against a brick wall, weeping in the cold, he found a row of cabinets. He set the lantern rattling upon a stained table, and approached the tallest of the cabinets. He could hear the rasp of his shoes on the stone floor, the rustle of his coat. The cabinet was not locked. The metal doors shivered and banged loudly as he unlatched them, and the sound ricocheted off into the gloom. The upper shelf was filled with files loose in their boxes, and the second and third shelves with jars of varying sizes, their shadowed contents adrift within, like deformed castings from Tussaud's waxworks, and then on the lowest shelf, he saw what he had come for. It was a big tank, too heavy for him to move, filled with a coalescing darkness, as if some horror floated just out of sight. He did not know at first what he was looking at, and then he saw it. Pale, hooded, like a thing dredged from the ocean depths, rubbery and reeking and unidentifiable, its wounds puckered and gilling in the formalin like tiny reefed mouths. A woman's torso, umbrageous and adrift. He stood a long time there and at last reached down and lifted a smaller jar out and set it on the table beside the lantern. He unshuttered the lantern's eye, and a cold light poured through its glass walls. He leaned in. A label had been affixed to one curve of the jar, with several numbers and letters identifying the remains within. This meant nothing to him. As he turned the glass to see past the adhesive, a kind of silt stirred in a slow cyclone in the foggy liquid, lit as it was by that lantern, and he understood that these were pieces of her that had come off in the formalin. And then slowly, languidly, the head drifted its face towards him. He did not know her. She was slack, the cheeks belling upward in their floating, her eyes milky and smooth. The head was angled slightly backward from the weight of the brain pan, as if to stare at the heavy, threaded lid when it had closed, and then one temple bumped the edge of the jar as it turned, and he watched it, feeling nothing he could put a name to. They had been 2 days out from Boston when New Year's Eve overtook the Orania, and he remembered standing in the icy night air of the saloon deck and staring through the blazing windows at the passengers laughing and drinking there. The piano hammering out some tune about a sailor and his paddle, all of it vaguely suggestive and ugly. The oblong cuts of light sliding slantwise across the deck from the big windows. The blur of evening suits and women in their silks and shawls and elaborate twists of hair in the French fashion. He had thought how they all must appear to any eye lurking out there in that frigid black sea, last and only survivors of some catastrophe, perhaps, how they sailed onward, singing and drinking in a light of their own making, while all around them darkness held them, and not a one looked out into it and saw it for what it was. He remembered peering in through the fogged glass, as if through the wall of some aquarium, and catching a glimpse of Molly where she stood beside a brass globe of the earth, with a stem of crystal clutched in one hand, and her face downturned, and how the music had warpled and thickened in his ears when she lifted her head. He had raised his hand, but she did not respond, and then he had understood. She could see only her watery self reflected in the glass. How small we are, how blind, how little we see and how much we are seen. The head drifted slowly past in its murky yellow keeping. Charlotte, he whispered. Oh, Charlotte. And closed his eyes. 12. William opened his eyes. His head hurt. It was already noon. The bedding had come loose as he slept and had folded up around his skull like a shroud, and he pulled it off and threw it aside in disgust. He could see the smudged soot where his hair had stained it in the night. He rose and dressed and stood by the window a long while, smoking, knowing he would have to return to Sally Porter's tenement, though he did not want to go. The fog was thick in the street outside and the day grim, and the gaslights had been turned on by the hotel maid before he awoke, and then turned off again, for the glass was still warm. His thoughts turned to the giant, who had accosted him 2 days earlier, and then to the man's growled hint about the ghosted Edward Shade, and William frowned and clenched his teeth around the stem of his pipe. At the narrow writing desk he sat and withdrew a sheet of hotel stationery, and unstoppered a bottle of ink and wrote out the following. Mail. Mid-40s. Accent of indeterminate origin. England? Australia? Brown eyes so dark as to look black. Black hair, black beard. 6 feet 5 inches approx. 250 pounds approx. Claims employment through a Mr. Fool. Any record in files of. Most likely an alias. Very threatening. Speaks rough. Identifying marks several. Long scar at throat as if once garroted. Top of left ear missing. Scars on backs of hands. Knuckles. Include a circular burn on left wrist. Hot poker? Branding iron? Scar above right eye, shape of a star. Has air and look of a career criminal. Likely has served time. Cross-reference with rogues, gallery and miscellaneous. Identify. Send everything. He blew on the paper to dry it and read it slowly back to himself, and then folded it and sealed it, and addressed the envelope to the Pinkerton offices in Chicago. He double-checked the hour, and then withdrew a second blank sheet, and dipped the pen into the ink, and sat with the nib poised over the paper. Then he began a second, more halting letter. My dear Margaret, he wrote, yesterday's here are cold. It is the fog I do not care for. You would find it beautiful, I think. It is like the paintings you admired so much when we were in New York last spring. Tell the girls the ponies in England are not so fine as what we have back in Chicago. It is the bad air and no countryside that stunts them. It looks now like this business will be finished with shortly. All that remains is closing the file, and you know how that can go, well or ill. There is no predicting. I saw Sally Porter last week. She is quite ill. Benjamin Porter died before the new year. You will remember Benjamin from my father's stories. They were fallen on hard times. I guess it is not easy. Write me when you can. I do not go to sleep without you and the girls beside me. Margaret, if I... Here he stopped and wiped the nib dry with a cloth and studied the letter as it dried. It did not say what he wanted to say. It did not ever manage to. There were men with the gift for writing their mind, but he would not ever be of their number. He stoppered the ink. He was thinking of Isabel, his eldest, and the long sickness she had suffered that autumn, and how he and Margaret had feared for her. She would be 18 this year. She had been sickly her entire life, and the skeletal shift of her wrist bones through her skin left him fearful for her even now. He could remember the green smell of her sick room, and the condensation running down the panes of the glass in the morning light, and how he would stand amid her kicked-off blankets and gaze down at her. How helpless he'd felt. He wanted to write this, but could not think how to start. After a moment he crossed out the last of the letter and wrote, instead, "You were right. I should not have come." Then he sat back and stared out the window, then folded the letter in distaste, and slid it into an envelope, but did not seal it. He opened the lowest drawer of the desk, dropped it in. Within lay a stack of similar letters addressed and unsealed and all unmailed. Margaret had come upstairs to his study one night last November after the girls were asleep. William had been seated with the lights off, and one big hand open on his desk when she came in. The sycamore outside the window, its naked white branches upraised, and the moon in cold profile burning beyond. "What do you aim to do?" Margaret had asked him from the doorway. She was carrying a candle in its saucer, and its soft, waxy light pulled him back to himself. She came in, set the candle on the edge of his desk among the opened files, sifted languidly through the papers, the testimony of Charlotte Reckitt, the timesheets and official reports of his father's operatives. She picked up the rogue's gallery photograph. "Is this her?" she asked softly. He nodded. "Charlotte Reckitt," he said. "My father was certain she could lead him to shade. She's pretty." He felt the blood rise to his cheeks. "She's as crooked as my second finger," he said. "And she's in London." "Apparently." They were silent then, and William studied the slim outline of his wife. She was still a beautiful woman. There were owls that hunted from the fence posts of the yard, but they were silent now, and in the stillness William felt some part of him breaking. He had spoken of Charlotte Reckitt and his father's interest in Edward Shade, and Margaret had listened in patience in the month since his father's death, but he understood there were limits to compassion. He watched her turn in her nightdress and drift quietly back towards the hall, taking the light with her. In the doorway she stopped. "You mean to go to her?" Margaret murmured. It was not quite a question. When he said nothing, she added, "Because your father would have wanted it." He shrugged uneasily in the candlelight. A sliver of shadow had cast itself knife-like under Margaret's nose and across her lips, giving her a ferocious aspect. He could not make out her eyes. "The hell with your father," she said from the doorway. It was already late in the day, and he knew that he would need to make his way to Snowfields across the Thames to talk to Sally Porter. He wanted to tell her Shaw's account of Edward Shade dying in the war, and to hear her explain it. There was little enough sense in it, he knew, but he did not know what else to do with himself. He should not have slept as late as he had. He locked his door carefully, and made his way down the hall and punched the buzzer for the elevator. He carried his Colt Navy in the pocket of his overcoat. He liked very little about the modern world, but he did like its firearms, and its railroads and its elevators, with their plush benches and fine mahogany detailing. As the cage rattled shut, he nodded to the operator and set his hands into his pockets. The operator, he noticed, was a different young man, one he had not seen before. They did not speak. In the lobby, a familiar figure was lounging under the palm frond. "Afternoon, Inspector," he said. Blackwell turned with a start.
"Mr. Pinkerton, sir," he said. "You're awake."
"In body, at least." Blackwell nodded. He appeared agitated and shifted his hat from one hand to the other. "What is it? Has John arranged it already?"
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
"Don't beg. It's unbecoming. Has Mr. Shaw instructed you to take me to Millbank?"
"Millbank, sir."
William studied him. "Blackwell, why are you here?"
"It's the legs, sir."
"They found them in a sack near Southwark Park, in Bermondsey." "Both of them?" Even as he said it, the question disturbed him, and he ran a hand along his jaw.
"Yes, sir,"
Blackwell said. "Both of them." They went out through the glass doors into the grey afternoon. It felt quiet, dull, eerily empty for the hour, and though it was Saturday, William wondered suddenly where all of the traffic had gone to. After a moment, Blackwell returned in a hansom and offered his hand, and William climbed grimly aboard. They travelled across Westminster Bridge, through the toll booths, into the foul warren of Bermondsey. Soap scum frothing in the ditches, crumbling wooden piles rising out of the green waters, the reeking tannery pits where men in rags stirred with long poles the drenched hides, the warehouses on their creaking wharves, the shabbily dressed children trotting alongside them. William strangled a yawn, glanced at the man beside him.
"No jokes today, Blackwell?"
"No, sir. Not today."
"How about something's afoot?"
Blackwell nodded unhappily.
"Very good, sir."
"This will help us to get a leg up. Soon we'll have this in the bag."
Blackwell looked away. The cruelty in his tone surprised him, and he fell silent. The stink had soured in the days since he had last come through here, and he watched the low, slouching shop fronts and warehouses with a sadness. He thought of Sally Porter in her little room, and felt all at once a pain in his abdomen, and he winced and pressed a handkerchief to his mouth. He understood Sally had worked for his father almost her entire free life, and that she would hold many of his father's secrets in trust, and it was churlish of him to resent her for it. William told himself it was not her lack of forthrightness which bothered him so much as the concealing of it, but this, he knew, was not true. The white lead paint on the sills of the buildings had blackened to a tar in the toxic air. There were ditches festering under the slat boardwalks, and slow, mephitic bubbles oozing in the muck, and he could see the frozen bodies of dogs twisted and strangled in the weeds. At times the fog would thin, and he would glimpse ditches boiling red with the dyes, and then the fog would close in again. He imagined Sally sitting very still in her shabby room, listening to his footsteps recede down the hall, and thinking of young Edward Shade in the war. A figment. A ghost. They turned up Jamaica Road and then up Drummond, past the huge chimneyed factory of Peake, Freen and Company, an awful sweetness pouring from its ovens into the streets.
"The residents call it Biscuit Town, sir,"
Blackwell muttered. The pain in his voice baffled William, and he said nothing. The hansom stopped outside an overgrown lot across from a factory with broken windows and a crumbling chimney, and William at first thought the place deserted. Then he saw the pale faces in the upper windows gathered there, and he studied their merciless curiosity with an interest of his own. A constable was standing at the corner of the square with his truncheon loose in his fist, though the onlookers kept warily off the street. Shopkeepers stood in their doorways with their aprons on, and their shirt sleeves rolled, each peering out from his respective darkness. The air was close, thick, reeking. The fog was dense. William could make out the skeletal figure of Breck crouching, straightening, moving about in the grey.
"Well, it's in the afternoon editions," Shaw murmured as they approached. His eyes had a brittle shine to them. "Police deny knowledge of head found in Thames."
"Let me see."
Shaw had been banging the rolled newspaper against his thigh with a soft, dull thwap.
"You're in it, too." "I hate these things. Too much appears in them that never appears out of them."
But he took the paper and unrolled it and scanned the columns as the fog curled between their boots, seethed over the wet earth.
"Scotland Yard is assisted in these investigations by William Pinkerton, current head of the Pinkerton Defective Agency of Chicago and New York. He looked up. Defective? Aye. Don't you have copy editors over here? Shaw smiled a smile of small brown teeth. Robert will be livid. Your brother has a temper, does he? William trudged past the chief inspector to the sacking, half hidden in the long weeds of the ditch. A temper? Yes. It's what makes him such an excellent defective. Anyone touched this yet? Aye, Dr. Breck. Some of the lads when they first arrived. William kneeled beside the sack and pulled off his gloves and lifted the opening cautiously wide. The legs had been stuffed feet first into the sack, and he could see the pale, split bones splintering out from the stumps. Something about it was more terrible in its wrongness than what he had so far witnessed. He had been to the slaughter yards in Chicago often in his work, and he thought now of the twisting shanks of meat rattling on their chains in the cold storage, and of the quiet chill he felt whenever he went through. The echo of violence and pain, almost like a sound in those sober warehouses. He closed the bag. The sacking was dry and crusted with blood, and it crumpled roughly under his fingers. Through the drifting fog he could see the figures of constables working their way over the rutted ground. He thought of the open sky of the Midwest, and the simple, bullet-riddled corpses of the bandits on display in their coffins on the boardwalks there, and of the good, clean work of it all. Well, Shaw said, what about it? William got to his feet, said nothing. Aye, Shaw grunted. Someone went to a regular lot of trouble to dump this. What? In some weeds? In a ditch? On the other bloody side of the city, Shaw growled. Could have saved himself the trouble and sunk the legs like he did the head. I take it no one saw anything? Never do. Not in Bermondsey. You've talked to the residents? Aye. William stood with his eyes fixed on the sacking and he thought about it. How long has it been here? Shaw shook his head. Since morning, Dr. Breck tells me. The blood's dried on the bag so the legs were stuffed in shortly after they were cut from the body. But the sack's just cold, and only a little damp on the underside, so it wasn't here in the night when it rained. And no one saw anything. As I said, poor woman. A squelching of shoes through the soft muck. A sniff. Breck loomed out of the mist, rubbing his fingers clean in a twist of handkerchief, as if he had just been sifting something foul. There are no footprints near the remains, he said curtly. There are now, William muttered. There are, however, and Breck half turned and gestured across a murky ditch, thick with grey watercress. Several indistinct marks leading back towards the park over there, most likely from a pair of shoes wrapped in cloth to hide their prints. What does that tell us? Shaw asked. That the dumping was done by a lone individual, William said quietly. And that he or she had the foresight to conceal their footprints, Breck continued, or that their shoes need to be protected from the mud. She, William said. Need to be protected, Shaw said. Because they're of high quality, you mean? Breck shrugged. She, William said again. Breck was leaning over his trunk and opening the lid, and he did not look up as he spoke. Perhaps. It is possible the body was cut up because it was too heavy to dispose of all in a piece, and it is possible the footprints would have given us some important detail about our suspect, such as a lady's footprints. Possible, William said, but likely? Possible, Breck said. He withdrew from his trunk a strange contraption. It appeared to be a bullseye lantern, but had been outfitted with a complicated series of lenses and refractors, and set upon a short handle. And when Breck opened its shutter, a powerful arc of light zeroed in on the sack. He had taken off his silk hat, and he folded his coat over the open lid of the trunk, and unhooked his spectacles, and then he put on a leather mask with straps that crossed at the nape and buckled together, so that a sequence of optical magnifiers on delicate rods could be swung out in front of the eyes. When he glanced up, his eyes goggled gruesomely out. He gave a strange sort of leer. Gentlemen, he said. Oh, for God's sake. Shaw put a hand on his hat. You'll make us a sideshow, Dr. Brick. You are already a sideshow, sir.
William watched him work with interest. The thin man kneeling in the muck, guiding that dazzling beam of light with one hand inch by inch over the sacking, lifting its edges with a small steel instrument in the shape of a fork with the other. He pried open the mouth of the sack, sniffed at its underlining without disturbing the remains within. After a moment he cocked his head and said, "Mr. Pinkerton, do you know what a collodion slide is?" William frowned. He had no idea. "In the leather box in the trunk," Breck said, "you will find a series of glass plates. Bring one to me." It was a glass plate, sticky with some adhesive substance, and the doctor took it from him without a word and bent back to his work.
"What have you found?" Shaw asked. "I cannot be certain."
Breck handed William the collodion slide and he held it carefully up, and could make out two tiny white insects pressed between the glass.
"The sack was not open like this earlier, sir. Has someone interfered with it? I instructed you to let no one near. Must I continually remind your constables what contamination means?"
Shaw said nothing. William said nothing. After a moment, Breck made a low, throaty grunt and leaned in deeper.
"The hairs on the legs are dark," he said. "But you will see, Mr. Shaw, here at the very tips of the follicles they appear grey, do they not? Most interesting. Mr. Pinkerton, another slide."
William obliged. The doctor took a second scraping, a third. After a moment, Shaw caught William's eye and they stepped back, away from the evidence.
"I wonder what hour the evening editions make the streets," he said.
William clapped his hands together for the cold.
"What are you thinking?"
"This was dropped here this morning. If news of the head was already out, it's entirely likely the drop was deliberate."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, maybe it wasn't about hiding anything." William was silent.
"We were supposed to find this bag today, and it'll be in the papers tomorrow."
Shaw nodded.
"But why in God's name would anyone do this? What's the point? To terrify people? To taunt us?
Maybe to send a message."
"A message?"
William shrugged. After a moment he said,
"You'll bury her now, I guess. That might be how you do things in Chicago. Bury our dead. Bury the evidence. I guess so. I guess we're just crazy enough to do that.
She doesn't seem to have any relatives, other than her uncle.
Nah, we'll keep her out of the ground a while yet. Until you've got a handle on this. Or until someone comes forward with a claim to her."
Shaw ran the water from his forehead with a thumb. It was a wet fog, and William could feel the damp seeping through his own coat.
"I keep meaning to ask," Shaw said. "The missus has been hoping to have you out at the house for an evening. Our cook makes a rather fine blood pudding."
"Blood pudding? Why?"
"If I'm here long enough," he said, "I just might brave it."
In the fog, the cold street looked ghostly. "I've got a wife and daughters to get back to, John, and the agency needs me."
"That would be your defective agency?"
William smiled.
"Sounds like you have two wives," Shaw said.
"Margaret says it herself."
"When Dr. Breck is finished, I want you to get this cleared out, lads," Shaw said suddenly to two constables at work searching the weeds. "Be careful with it. Anything might be of use to us."
He turned back to William.
"About Martin Reckitt," he said. "Take Blackwell with you on Wednesday and see what you can get out of him. I've got you your hour."
William watched the men at their labours in the mist.
"All right," he said.
He made his way back at last to Sally Porter's tenement behind Snow Fields. He had been dreading doing so, but wanted to hear her account for herself directly. If Shaw's account of the Porters smuggling Shade through Virginia was true, then Sally had lied to him, had sat shivering across from him in her darkness, and lied. He could not think why she would keep such a detail from him, except that his father, too, had done so. He thought again of that toast to the Union dead his father had raised in the year of the war's ending, that sad litany of names, of the boy Edward, who completed the list. His father had once, it seemed, believed Edward Shade to have died.
Whatever had caused him to doubt it remained a mystery. What was clear to William was that his father had believed it, and his father, whatever else, was never a fool. The shop windows he passed were dusty in the chill, and he could see the vague silhouettes of flypaper and thin strips of grey meat on hooks through the glass. Sally's lie to him, that shade was never real, might, he thought suddenly, be connected to her knowing some truth about the matter. She might be able to tell him what it was that had so convinced his father of Edward Shade's survival. What secret was she keeping? He walked on over the clattering slat-board walks, speaking to no one, and ignoring the cries of the beggars from their ditch-side perches. He felt wearied by the discovery of the legs, saddened by the whole shabby business of it. He had thought to make his way to the pub surrounding the London docks after, but as the afternoon waned into evening, he understood it would have to wait. After a time he took his bearings and turned left, and slipped down a wretched alley and through a broken iron gate into the worm-rotted stairwell of Sally Porter's building. A dog was nosing some wadded rag in the shadow, and when he came in, it lifted its snout and growled. He stopped and regarded it. Then he turned away. The stairs shuddered under his heavy steps, but at the third-floor landing he paused. Her door stood open. He could see it from where he had stopped. He waited in that cold hallway and adjusted his hat and peered behind him, listening. There were raised voices coming from her room, and he frowned and felt in the pocket of his topcoat for his Colt, and then he made his slow approach. It was a family, destitute and filthy and squabbling in the chaos. He stood in the doorway a moment, confused. The old porter desk had been upturned and pushed against one wall, and the cracked elephant stood yet on the mantel above the old fireplace, though someone had hung a rag from its trunk to dry. The woman, girl, mother of that brood, had let out a screech and was swatting at one child, and then picking up a knife from the table when she saw him, and then all fell silent. "Hello," he said, something sinking inside him. She came at him with a directness and speed that alarmed him. He stepped back, though he was thrice her size and well acquainted with knives. She stood in the doorway, pushing at the head of a child in her skirts, its face all filth and rage.
"We ain't paying it twice," she snapped. "We ain't paying you neither."
He held up his hands. "Where's Sally?" he said. Her eyes narrowed.
"Ain't you for the rent?"
"I'm not for the rent." A green blanket had been strung up on a rope, cutting the bed from William's sight, and a long, low, racked cough started from behind it, and an elbow bloomed against the blanket, and then a man's hoarse voice cried out.
"Who is it, Mags?"
he called.
"What do we want?"
"You've got a tongue in your head. You ask him."
She had small, sharp shoulders, and hands the size of a child's, and her reddish hair was filthy and shorn along her scalp, where she must have cut it for the money. A flea-bitten child squalled at her thigh, tugged the hem of her dress, its little knuckles blacked, its little face blacked.
"What do we want?"
the man called again.
"He don't want the rent,"
she hollered, then scowled up at William.
"Well, what is it?"
"I'm looking for someone," he said. He fished out a shilling. "The woman who used to live here," he said. "The old woman, the Negro. What do you know of her? Where did she go to?" Her hand absorbed the coin as if it were water, and she tilted a sudden coy glance at him, slid one arm along the door jamb. He saw now she could not be older than 16.
"You want to come in and talk about it, mister?"
she asked.
"You just come right in, like."
"I was here last week," he said. He stepped back and stared down the hallway, and then looked at the girl. "I talked to her last week, right here."
"Last week, was it?"
"She never said anything about leaving."
"God damn it, Mags!" the man called from within. "Shut that damn door!"
"You wait!"
she barked over her shoulder. She peered back up at William with an expression of disgust.
"Last week's a lifetime ago, isn't it? All we was told was no one got theirselves murdered in here and the rooms was available right away. Never asked no other questions." "She were a Negro?"
he nodded.
"A Negro woman?"
he nodded.
"Well, she ain't hiding in the fireplace and we ain't cooked her and ate her."
She shook her head as if giving up on him and started to shut the door. He put out his hand, held the door fast. "She didn't just vanish," he said. The girl shrugged angrily.
"People do,"
she said. He came out of the tenement with his hackles prickling, as if some shadow watched him through the haze, but he could see no one. He took two steps backward into the muck of the street and squinted up at snow fields, its broken, lightless panes, looking for Sally's window. His entire life he had lived with the knowledge that vanishings were real, that people disappeared. Why it should astonish him now he could not say. He trudged up Tooley Street, and at Vine stopped and looked around him, uneasy, the air reeking with the sludge of the river, the buildings leaning crazily out of the fog. Wherever Sally had gone, she had left her furniture behind, and he did not know if this meant she was dead, or had simply lighted out for other lodgings.
"The hell with it,"
he thought sharply. It had been years since he had seen her, and whatever her love for his father, she owed William nothing. There were figures drifting past now at the edges of the buildings, but he could not make out their faces. He could not quit himself of a growing dread that some figure lurked there behind him with malice in its heart, and he ducked into a small court and crossed it quickly, his soles slipping in the mud. At a gap in the far railing he squeezed through and went down towards Pickle Herring Street, and the small iron-walled kiosk of the pedestrian tunnel, squatting there like some armored outpost set over the river. The bridges, he knew, would still be open to foot traffic, but the tower subway would be quieter, and if he had been followed he would lose his shadow here. He glanced behind him, dipped his head, paid his halfpenny, and went down. It was a wooden spiral staircase that creaked under his steps, and dislodged a fine sifting of dirt as he went. The brick walls were greasy with some filth, the gas lights in their blue globes sickly and dimming as he went deeper, as the air worsened. He came out into a vaulted chamber some 50 feet below the riverbank, and stood staring at the round entrance of the iron tube, as if staring at the threshold of some other world, and then he peered back up the shaft of the stairwell to the small eye of light above him. In the tunnel were globe lights, affixed naked to the riveted walls, and visible from where he stood, but even as he stepped through and began his slow walk under the river, the air thickened into a grey haze. The corridor stretched on, eerie in its solitude. Twin rails ran the length, laid once for a cable omnibus, now long in ruin. He could not shake the feeling that he was walking very gradually downhill, deeper into the earth, that the floor was lifting and falling under him like the deck of a vessel in a current. Through the tunnel's iron walls, he could hear the heavy thrump of a paddle steamer in the river above. When he looked behind him, he could not see where he had set out from, and when he turned back, he could not see where he was going, and that passage in its grey hopelessness seemed to go on forever. He heard them before he saw them, the crunch of their steps behind him, the huge rustle of their topcoats, a rasping cough. Hearing some purposeful thing in their approach, and having known too many footpaths to mistake it, he turned, fists bared, and waited. And then, through the haze, two monstrous figures, distorted and indistinct in the gloom, the sepulchral gas hissing behind them. He did not move, and the two figures behind him stopped, and he could hear the blood loud in his ears, feel the weight of the river crushing down through the clay.
"Show yourselves,"
he said, his voice echoing off the length of the tunnel. The two figures stood in their vague, unsettling silence, watching him from the haze. Then came a slight crunch of stones on the tiles underfoot, and William felt the hairs rise on the back of his neck, and he took a step back, knees bent, fists doubled.
"Show yourselves, by God!"
"Mr. Pinkerton," a voice said.
William withdrew his colt, and very deliberately, in the long silence of that tunnel, he cocked the hammer.
"There'll be no violence from us," the man said softly, stepping forward into the light. "I assure you of that, sir."
The man who stood before him was small, narrow in the shoulders, thin-throated. His long whiskers were white, startling against his dark skin. He held an expensive silver-tipped walking stick in one hand, and tucked a thumb into a satin waistcoat pocket with the other. The line of his mouth under the shadow looked worn, aggrieved, angry with some undefined hurt. William felt a kind of disquiet go through him. He did not put away his revolver. "My name is Adam Foon," the small man said. "I believe my manservant spoke with you. If you'll forgive my seeking you out in this fashion."
"What do you want?"
"The same as you, Mr. Pinkerton. To find the killer of Charlotte Reckitt." William's eyes shifted to the other figure, massive, all stooped shoulder and thigh, his bowler hat crushed up against the ceiling. He knew that one at once. It was the ex-convict from the cafe.
"Tell your man to step forward," he said, "into the light, where I can see him."
"There's no need for that."
"Step forward," he called.
The giant did not stir.
"He intends you no harm, Mr. Pinkerton,"
the man murmured. His shadowed eyes, his face emotionless in the gloom, his small hands very still. He neither wept nor remonstrated, and instead a current of tension tightened in him, and William recognized it as an authentic grief.
"I understand you are a serious man, sir, an effective man. That is why I have come to you, to ask for your assistance."
"I'm not for hire."
"I do not wish to be a client, Mr. Pinkerton. I wish to enlist your help, privately."
William's eyes shifted coldly between the two men. He had not yet uncocked his revolver.
"It would be to your benefit also, sir."
"What's your interest in Charlotte Reckitt?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"Your interest?"
"My interest is in her killer."
The small man paused, raised his face.
"Charlotte mattered to me once," he said. "Our lives diverged. I have always regretted the path hers took. She was not a bad person, Mr. Pinkerton, and never a cruel one, whatever her affiliations."
William frowned.
"You and her, you were
intimate." "Yes, I am not ashamed of it."
While he spoke, William was listening for other sounds in the tunnel, but he heard nothing. If there were others gathered in ambush, they were not close. William could see the man's bright eyes glittering in the shadow of his silk hat.
"There is a city under the city, Mr. Pinkerton. If you want answers, that is where you must go."
William shifted his weight, stepped closer.
"Mr. Pinkerton," the giant said, "that's near enough now."
The small man took no notice.
"There is a man," he said instead, "named Jonathan Cooper. Called himself the Saracen. He was famous in certain circles for removing the heads of his victims and floating them down the Thames. You have heard of him, perhaps? He worked with Charlotte, and when they parted ways, he disappeared. It was said she'd betrayed him, cheated him." The weak gaslight again caught the man fool's face, and his features were fierce, his violet eyes piercing.
"The mutilations to her torso? As if to make her suffer? The sawed-off head? This is Cooper's work, Mr. Pinkerton."
"Anyone can cut off a head."
"She knew him."
"So you say."
Adam Fool smiled a tired smile.
"The only way to find this man, this Saracen, is to find the woman he was devoted to. A mudlark. Goes by the name of Muck Annie. She lives in the sewers south of Blackfriars."
"You want me to go into the sewers?"
"Into the tunnel arches? Yes."
"You know where to find her. You go."
"And what would I do, should this mudlark lead me to the Saracen?"
"Consider me, sir." He held out his arms, the walking stick dangling from a lilac glove.
"Whereas you, sir,
you are the fearsome William Pinkerton. You can subdue a man and make him confess, no matter how fierce.
No. If one wishes a task done well, one seeks out the talent."
"Your man there looks like he could handle it."
"But he is not the law, Mr. Pinkerton, nor is he the greatest detective of our age."
William spat.
"I'm not the law either."
"Well,"
the man said, clicking his tongue,
"even better, perhaps."
"It won't work," William murmured, drifting nearer. "I know your sort. You and I would want different things out of this."
His boots crunched in the slow gravel as he stepped off the rails. All at once the giant slid languid and cat-like from his position in the gloom, and loomed up behind Adam Fool, and William saw the brass knuckles glinting there.
"That's near enough now," the giant growled. "Step yourself back."
William looked at him. "Gentlemen," Fool said, half-turning, "that's enough. My man means no harm, Mr. Pinkerton. We simply wanted a private moment with you. Now tell me, please, what is it you imagine I want out of this?"
"Revenge," said William.
"Not justice?"
"Not justice. And don't tell me they're the same thing."
"Oh, but sometimes they are, Mr. Pinkerton, as you know." William felt a sudden, quick anger. He did not ask which side of the law that placed the man on. It was a blurred line that made little sense in the distinguishing of right from wrong, and in the end he believed it no way to measure a man's worth.
"Just consider it.
That is all I ask."
"I'm not interested."
The man, Fool, frowned and belled out one whiskered cheek, and then he nodded imperceptibly to himself.
"I made a promise to Miss Reckitt 10 years ago," he said, "a promise I wish to honor.
I know you understand. I've been following your career with interest. You are not a man who betrays his word. We are not so different, you and I."
He tapped his walking stick against the iron rails underfoot. "There is a boy who works the lay in Waterloo Place, a gunsmith's apprentice, Albert. If you are willing to consider this, you can send to me through him. He will know how to contact me."
William glanced from the small man to his companion lurking in the haze. "What makes you think I'd trust you?"
"Oh, trust," the small man said, scraping a half circle on the tunnel floor with his walking stick. "I wouldn't ask that of you."
He met William's eye with a sudden hard expression that chilled William.
"She didn't deserve to die like that, Mr. Pinkerton. I know that you terrified her, but her death was not your fault."
William was quiet for a long moment. He did not see how the man could know that. He had shadowed Charlotte Reckitt for weeks, and never seen this man cross her path.
"I am prepared to offer something of value in return, of course," the man said. "An account you might find of interest. I understand you've been into every flash house in the city, asking after a man who doesn't exist. You've made no secret of it."
William could feel the thrum of the river through the iron walls, and he ran a hand along the back of his neck. His hand was shaking.
"Edward Shade," he said.
"Yes."
"Shade's dead," he said sharply. "He died in the war."
"Who told you such a thing?"
William paused, regarded the man. Adam Fool raised his weary face, peered at him from the darkness.
"It wasn't the war that killed that boy, Mr. Pinkerton," he murmured. "It was your father."
The Ghost Special, 1868, Ohio. The first time William Pinkerton heard the name Edward Shade, he was 22 years old, and drinking in the gaslit saloon of Cincinnati's Rand Hotel. He was standing with his father and George Bangs, and all three had a boot heel hooked in the brass rail, and their wide-brimmed hats set down before them on the bar. In time he would lose his father to that rumor, as other boys lost their fathers to clouds of pox, or sudden floods, or to the flare of a spark in a curtain. His father, with his gray beard and his thick ropey forearms, and the skin of his hands so thorny and calloused as to look diseased. His father, with his burning gray eyes like a prophet out of some Old Testament squall. As a boy he had been his father's shadow, and never once seen him proved wrong. He had learned from him in the fields outside Chicago how to tie a blanket to a saddle, and in the sawmills how to lean his weight into a cut, and in the rivers how to clean a trout with a flick of a blade. All this had been in him during the second year of the war, when he had spied for his father in McClellan's lines, and all this was in him still on that day, oiled and readied, like a bullet in the chamber of a rifle. It was the year of the Reno business. The war had been over 3 winters by then.
"You don't like this,"
his father was saying to Bangs, his powerful neck turning.
"I don't. You don't like me going after John Reno. I don't like your interest in a town like Seymour.
His father's eyes mostly smoldered with a peculiar light, but now a darkness passed over them. He was not as big as either of his sons, but he was hard as a plank of hickory, and his fists were heavy as Scottish Bibles.
Seymour's a cancer, he said softly. Should have burned it to the ground years ago. Maybe.
His father took a sip of cloudy water. The shot glass clicked down.
You won't find him there, Bang said suddenly. Shade isn't the type to go west, Alan, if he even still exists, or ever existed.
William ran a finger over the brass rim of his own shot glass, regarded the older men. I thought we were hunting John Reno, he said. Bangs nodded at his father, as if weighting some invisible scale and eyeing the balance. Then he said to William,
Your father has a notion there might be more in Seymour than just John Reno and his brothers. Edward Shade's been a puzzle since, what, 66?
His father grunted.
Alan, we'll take John Reno by surprise, his father said instead. Warrant or no warrant, cut off the head of the snake. Then we'll find out what his brothers can do. Willie, he said.
Yes, sir.
Go see to the horses.
William got up from the bar.
What you're suggesting is kidnapping, Bang said abruptly. We have no jurisdiction in Indiana.
William met his father's eye.
That's right, his father said.
Bangs was shaking his head.
The ends don't justify the means, Alan. They don't ever. You tell him, William. He won't listen to me.
William put on his hat. Sometimes they do, Mr. Bangs, he said. The Renos were a tough and brutal family of eight, and John, the second son. In the last year of the war, he had galloped up out of the White River bottomlands with his brothers at his side, 2 miles northwest of Seymour, Indiana, a Colt strapped to each hip, and the fingertips of his rawhide gloves scissored off. He was a powerful man with the straight shoulders and high cheekbones of a Blackfoot brave, and the long arms and big hands of his French forebears, and he was black-haired and handsome as the devil himself. In the weeks following Appomattox, he had bought up much of the nearby town of Rockford, after several fires broke out, and the rest he would take by fear and bribery, until that town, too, belonged to him. In the fall of 1865, he took his brothers Simeon and William and Frank, and stole and murdered his way through the county, as if riding in a Confederate raid, and in the spring of 1866, he stormed the Clinton County Treasury, and blew out its walls with black powder. That was the year the Renos startled the nation by robbing the Adams Express car of $15,000 while still at speed. And this new thing, what could you call it, this train robbery, drew the interest of the agency. Then in early 1867, they stole $22,065 from the Davies County Treasury in Gallatin, Missouri, and the Pinkertons rolled up their sleeves and got to work.
Tell me about the man, his father said later that day.
Bespectacled, lights winking like twin coins in the lenses, his voice tired, his skin drained and grey in the afternoon gloom.
Tell me about this Winscott.
William stood at the window watching the rain. His stained oilskin seemed tight at his shoulders, the warped floorboards creaking under his boots. A piano was playing somewhere in the hotel, a woman's low voice singing. A gust rolled across the glass. The thin walls groaned. He worried the papers in one hand and scanned the notes in the margins, then flipped back to the first page.
Dick Winscott, he said, 36 years old, black hair, a scar over his left eyelid. Runs the saloon in Seymour.
He's been with the agency since the end of the war, working out of the Denver office. Jim McParland vouches for him. His father chewed a lip, his wiry gray beard working. He's a big man, 6'2", good with his fists. Complexion is real dark like a mix, it says here. Has a tooth out in front, carries a lot of hardware and is a good shot. Says he was with the artillery at Second Bull Run, lucky enough or clever enough not to get himself killed.
William glanced up. Either way, it's a good thing for us. Active in Seymour since last spring when we sent him in.
MacParlan did a job on his identity. There's a copy of a police record here. It says they even made up an old wanted poster for him.
That's good.
William had seen the man in Denver 2 years before, skulking in a stairwell, soiled outrider's hat shading his eyes, hot reek of the stables steaming up from his shirt. He could have been anyone in from the borderlands. Concerns? William ran a palm along his jaw. He had not shaved in several days, nor washed, and the dust of the roads itched under his collar. The Renos seemed to trust him, he said. The trick will be to take John Reno without betraying Winscott as one of ours.
Why? Jesus, Pa. I'm not green.
Watch your language.
Why?
Because we still got a stable's worth of other Renos to pull in.
Good. What's the going concern here?
William glanced at the four pistols where they sat on the bed with the Enfield rifle laid out across them.
To do it quick, he said, so as not to have to kill him.
And if he isn't alone?
William thought about this.
He will be.
Winscott says if he can just get him to the depot for the mail express, we ought to be able to take him. And if we can get to him quick before he can draw, we should have him trussed up before any of his brothers can even saddle a horse.
His father unhooked his spectacles, rubbed at his temple with two fingers. With its cropped grey hair and shorn beard, his head looked hammered and square, like a convict's.
If he's alone, I'll be damn impressed, he muttered.
Your head bothering you again?
Don't you start on that, his father said. I get it enough from your mother.
William watched him with troubled eyes, and his father glared.
If he isn't alone, we go ahead with it anyway, he went on. This is the one chance we've got to control the thing.
What?
It's nothing.
His father put back on his spectacles, studied his son.
Out with it.
You sure this is how you want to do this?
If a fight has to come, let it come, and the sooner the better. You know my policy.
Show your fists.
Show your fists. Strike first and so hard they don't get back up. Fair is a fool's notion, Willie.
His father crossed and uncrossed his legs. He seemed to have finished. But then, after a moment, he muttered,
God knows I have enough to do without getting complaints from you.
It wasn't a complaint.
I'll tell you another thing. After I am dead, and the sod is growing over my grave, then you'll know what it means to take over the management of everything.
All right.
But while I live, I mean to be the principal of this agency. When I'm right, and nothing will influence me otherwise. You tell that to Mr. Barnes.
What does he have to do with it?
Principal, he repeated, until death claims me as its own. Then you can pick over the carcass and much luck to the lot of you.
William blew out his cheeks. His father took out a silver pocket watch, lifted it to one ear to check its gears.
Where is he now, or Mr. Barnes?
William set down the papers in irritation, and studied his father, and started to say something, then thought better of it and said nothing.
Is the special arranged? His father asked.
We've got our ops mustered down at the station. Five of them. They're brutes, he added with a shy grin.
There's a head of steam up on the engine, and we're just waiting on word.
I believe Mr. Bangs is at the telegraph office. Just in case.
What have they been told?
Nothing yet.
His father grunted.
Good.
William observed the descending darkness. He did not think word would come today.
This shade character, he said instead.
His father leaned forward, fumbled at his boots.
Pa, what happened in 66?
He sat back and was still.
What?
Edward Shade. Should I be worried?
No,
he said.
All right. I mean it.
All right.
His father was staring at him with hard, bloodshot eyes, and William saw in that visage something he did not like, but that he knew was in him also. It had to do with fate and betrayal and some crueler thing that was a hole in the heart where remorse should have been. After a moment, his father steepled his